Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, so we are reaching into the vault to bring you an older episode of the show. This one originally published on September 27th, 2022. It was one we did on the invention of the gimbal.
All right, let's dive right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
And I want to start this episode with a quote, just because this is where my mind instantly went for this episode, which is going to be about the gimbal. I thought of this line from the poem The Jabberwocky by Lewis Carroll.
Okay.
"'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe."
Okay, so I was about to say that every noun, verb, and adjective in this couplet is nonsense, but then I realized there are actually a couple of real verbs in there. There's "twas" and there's "did." In fact, actually, "twas," I think, contains a noun and a verb, because the T in "twas" is for "it." So we get "it was" and "did," but yeah, everything else, I don't know what those words mean. And I think you're not supposed to.
Well, gyre is real, to whirl or to gyrate.
Do you think that's what it's supposed to mean in this context, though?
I think yes, or mostly yes.
Just, oh, okay.
But that's the thing about Lewis Carroll, a lot of nonsense words. And then gimbal throws one off, because when you look at this, gimbal, as in the title of this episode, in case you don't have the title in front of you, is spelled G-I-M-B-A-L. And in the Lewis Carroll poem, it's spelled G-I-M-B-L-E. And if you look that spelling of gimbal up in a dictionary, you get to make a face or to grimace, which does not seem to be what's going on here. The gimbal we're talking about is, as we'll define more clearly in a bit, a mechanism typically consisting of rings pivoting at right angles for keeping an instrument horizontal in a moving vessel or on a moving plane, that sort of thing. So that definition would seem to sort of line up more with what's going on here, the idea of some sort of gyre, some sort of revolution going on. But I read a little bit more about this, and it turns out that Lewis Carroll is absolutely of no help to us today. in this text, apparently Humpty Dumpty himself weighs in. I either didn't know this or had forgotten this on the meaning of all this, pointing out that toves are a kind of lizard badger creature, and that gimbal in this context means, quote, to make holes like a gimlet. A gimlet is a hand tool for drilling small holes in wood. Slithy is a combination of lithe and slimy. So it's a slimy badger lizard that rotates and bores.
Okay, I see. But wait a minute. I'm still confused when you say that gimbal in this line means to make holes like a gimlet. Was that a general definition of the word at the time this poem was written, or is that unique to the meaning within the poem?
My understanding is that this is a Lewis Carroll thing.
Okay.
Humpty Dumpty is explaining it, because, or at least in the dictionaries I was looking at, I did not see this as an accepted definition or alternate definition for gimble, G-I-M-B-L-E.
Well, in that case, that would support my initial interpretation that even though gyre is a real word in this context, it is supposed to be a nonsense word.
Right. But the nonsense being perhaps less removed from the reality. Yeah, it's I mean, that's, I guess, the delight of Lewis Carroll text is you have all of these nonsense words. You have words that are being used, at the very least, in the pursuit of some sort of nonsense.
This may be the most whimsical opening ever to a podcast about a rotation mechanism.
Yeah, it's probably a bad opening since
the
example does not have a useful definition of the word involved. It's more of a tangent, but still, I mean, entertaining, I would hope.
I enjoyed going on this little Lewis Carroll journey with you. But okay, so we're going to talk about gimbals today. What is a gimbal? I think we might need to do a little bit of concept sorting, because when I was searching for information about gimbals on the internet, first of all, a lot of what comes up is just camera equipment, and we can discuss that later in the episode. But even when you're just trying to find information about the underlying mechanical concept, a lot of what comes up seems to be references to a complex device made out of three parts that are, in fact, each individually called a gimbal. So anyway, I got this sorted out by consulting a reference manual. I went to the Oxford Dictionary of Mechanical Engineering. If that's not an authoritative source, I don't know what is. And according to this volume, a gimbal is, quote, a pivoted support that allows rotation of a supported object about a single axis. Two orthogonal gimbals are used in supports of, for example, compasses. So I think the object mounted within a gimbal is most often going to be a platform that is supposed to maintain its orientation with respect to gravity, or it's some kind of detector, sensor, or measuring device. But when I was thinking about simple examples that people might know from around their homes, I actually thought of the C-shaped mounting for a globe. I actually was looking at a globe just the other day and admiring all of the like names of countries that are no longer accurate on it. But on a globe, you've got this, you know, often have this either a full ring or sort of a C-shaped metal ring that connects to the globe at the poles and allows the globe to rotate within it. And of course, this simulates the rotation of the Earth. Now, often when you read about references to gimbals, they will be referring to systems that use two or three or even more gimbals in combination, in succession with one another, to allow more dimensions of free rotation. For example, probably the most famous one is known as Cardan's suspension. And this is, again, according to the Oxford Handbook of Mechanical Engineering, quote, a system that uses three gimbals with orthogonal axes, orthogonal meaning at 90 degree angles, orthogonal axes so as to support a component in a fixed orientation despite rotation of the mounting of the gimbals.
Cardan, by the way, that's named for Girolamo Cardano, a 16th century Italian polymath who developed or made use of a three-ring gimbal.
Right, and the handbook goes on to say that the Cardan suspension is most often used to support gyroscopes for navigational use or for various types of experiments about freely rotating bodies. So to return to the globe analogy, imagine you've got a regular globe. It's got a C-shaped mounting that allows it to rotate freely on its axis. But then imagine you mount that C-shaped mounting to a ring that allows the C-shaped mounting to rotate freely on the equatorial axis. So that's two dimensions of rotation. And then say you mount that within a third ring, and within that ring, you can actually have the globe rotate sort of, say, top, front to back. And with these three rings, you can rotate freely in all three dimensions of space. The dimensions that in the context of, say, talking about the attitude of an airplane, you would call pitch, roll, and yaw. Now, there's normally no reason you would want a globe to rotate in three dimensions, but there are situations where it would be very useful to have an object mounted within two or three gimbals. For example, what if you want to create an object that maintains a fixed orientation with respect to some outside frame of reference, even though the ground or the housing in which the object is mounted will itself move? So say you want a platform that maintains orientation with respect to the Earth, maybe the Earth's center of gravity, or maintains orientation with respect to some point in the stars, or some fixed point of focus, like, say, the subject of a frame when you're using a camera, all while being mounted inside a housing that is prone to moving and jostling around. For a simpler version of all that, just imagine you want a cup holder or any open reservoir for liquid that will stay upright and not spill, even though it's, say, mounted in a ship that is expected to be going through rough seas.
Yeah, and looking around, I notice you can get some gimbaled drink holders for, I think, mostly boats. This reminds me, though, I think the earliest example of this mechanism that I remember seeing, I would have seen compasses and so forth, but a situation where someone was really calling out the gimbal technology was some sort of, I don't know if this was like a Mr. Wizard or Reading Rainbow or some Nickelodeon show, but it was like something with kid inventors, and kids were rolling out their inventions. And one of the kid inventions was essentially a gimbal drink tray. So I think if memory serves, these weren't round frames, but they were square frames, but it created the same sort of situation. And they demonstrated it showing like a glass of Coke or Pepsi, you know, there in the middle of it. And I remember at the time thinking, well, this is phenomenal. This is what we should use all the time. And of course, then you go back into the world and you realize, well, no, I guess the engineering benefits of this design do not make this a better option than simply being careful with a tray. But at the time, I remember being really impressed with it and thinking, well, this is the way. This is the way we should be carrying drinks around on trays. We should see this in every restaurant in every city around the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you're carrying your coffee cup and it's too full and it just starts sloshing back and forth and you're like, I've got to stop walking or I've got to spill it. That's pretty much it. A sort of gimbaled sling for your coffee cup, I suspect, would help overcome that problem.
Yeah, or say a martini glass, where it's like, this is a horrible design. Why? I could easily go off on the martini glass. So easy to slosh. But it makes you think, well, we got to have gimbal trays for these things. If we're going to insist on drinking out of these ridiculous glasses and not something more reasonable like a Coupe or a Nick and Nora, then let's get specialized trays.
You know, I think the poor design of the martini glass is actually intentional. There's like a psychological effect of the fact that it sloshes so easily. It makes the act of drinking the martini kind of delicate experience. So you imagine, I don't know, Don Draper having a martini or whatever, and he's not just knocking it back. You know, he's got to like hold it very carefully and sip it carefully, and it makes it a tender moment.
Yeah, and then I guess the threshold for becoming sloppy with your drink is that much closer, and therefore maybe the idea is, well, if they're having too much to drink, they're going to spill more of it. They'll spill more of it on themselves, and they'll think twice about ordering more of this particular beverage. They'll realize maybe I should just get a water and go home.
Maybe I should just get six dozen more oysters and then go to the meeting. Well, okay. Anyway, a lot of sources, if you try to look for the origins of the gimbal system, I think this is one of the many mechanical designs that we don't know for sure the actual origin of it. But one of the earliest mentions of a gimbal is often cited to a 3rd century BCE Greek engineer and author named Philo of Byzantium, or Philon of Byzantium. I was reading about this in a book called Gears, by Vincenzo Vullo, published by Springer in 2020. And there's just a short paragraph about Philo here. Vullo writes, quote, "Philo was also the first to describe a gimbal. It was applied to an 8-side ink pot that could be turned any way, driven by gears, without the ink being poured. This was done by suspending the inkwell at a central plate after assembling this on a series of concentric metal rings, which were stationary regardless of how the pot could rotate." Now, like many things, like many inventions mentioned in ancient Greek reference texts, this doesn't necessarily mean that Philo was the inventor of this object, or that Philo was the inventor of the gimbal or the gimbal system. But this does appear to be a very early, if not the earliest, written reference to it.
Yeah, in looking at and considering the history of the gimbal, I'm reminded of our discussions of the wheel. So you look at the history, and certainly we have an invention episode on the wheel, at least one. I can't remember if it's a one-parter or a two-parter. But one of the things we touched on is that it's one thing to happen upon the concept, to invent the concept of the wheel. But then how practical is it if you don't have roads? And so we have various examples of cultures where there wasn't really a practical use of the wheel, but the wheel was still around as a novelty. One would see it in the use of toys for children.
Mm-hmm.
And so one can easily imagine a situation where the gimbal is much the same, where craftsmen and curious minds would have happened upon this property, would have developed this. But if there's not something that you need to keep stable, and then why roll it out? Why make any more of an issue out of it? Because again, I come back to that example of the kid inventors with the with the tray. Like, that's cool and all, but if it's not actually better than just carefully carrying a tray, then it's not an invention that's going to actually have any legs.
Right, and in the end, a lot of the real uses of gimbal systems seem to be highly specialized. They're not usually like everyday use kind of objects. They're often for special kinds of detectors and sensors in special contexts. Of course, in scientific experiments, and later we'll get to this in space travel after the invention of photography. But earlier than that, at least in the use of sea navigation.
Right, right. At what point do you have something where it makes sense to bust out this technology to keep it stationary? Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
And you just said the word censor. You were, of course, referring to a different spelling and usage of the word. But in this, we're coming back to our discussion of incense and incense censors from the previous episodes of the show. Because as we teased towards the end of Incense Part 2, this episode on gimbals is kind of a continuation of that journey. So while a great deal of the history of incense usage has more to do with religion and pure aesthetics, there are still practical applications. And when we consider the technology of censers, again, dedicated incense burning containers and devices, things get a bit more complicated. And indeed, in this case, we see links between censers and gimbal technology that will ultimately play a big role in, say, the future of things like photography and marine navigation and even rocket science. But we can go back to very old traditions, very old technologies involving the use of incense. And I guess you might wonder, well, why would you need to use a gimbal on an incense? At which point does it pass that kid inventor test of the practicality, overpowering the pure novelty of the thing? So one of my main sources for this is a 2022 article by art historian Bing Huang, published in the journal Religions. He cites several sources here, including the work of noted sinologist Joseph Needham, whose writings we recently referenced on the show as well. This is an individual who casts a long shadow in the study of Chinese science and technology, especially in the West. His multi-volume work on the history of science and civilization in China was very much a career-defining work.
Mm-hmm.
So as Huang describes here, it would seem, based on Needham's research and writings, that Chinese knowledge of the gimbal dates back at least to the 2nd century CE, but also possibly to the 2nd century BCE. We have a poet by the name of Sima Shengru, who makes a reference to the Jinzun Sheng. These are the metal rings containing the burning perfume. And this is in the Mai Ren Fu. This is Ode on Beautiful Women, a poem that contains a seduction scene and in doing so describes these bedchambers and the items inside that bedchamber. And it's inferred then, in Needham's writing, that based on other texts, the artifact described here might in fact be a gimbal suspension to keep the burning perfume stable.
Ah, okay. So much like you might have, say, a cup holder on a boat that could use a gimbal system in order to keep the drink from spilling while the boat rocks in the waves, this could potentially be a container for burning incense that would use a gimbal system to keep it stable to make sure it didn't spill.
Right. Now, you may be wondering about the kid inventor test here. Like, why is it really necessary? Well, there's a potential answer for that, and I'll get to that in a second. But if this is true, this would seem to position the earliest Chinese references to gimbal pretty early on. In some cases, I don't know if this would necessarily be earlier than Philo, but certainly this would be pretty early on in Eastern traditions compared with Western traditions. I should note that when it comes to critics of Needham, a common one was that he tended toward Chinese superiority in his analysis. Apparently, other critics, however, argued quite the opposite, that he struggled to shake free of the shackles of European exceptionalism in his sinology. So, ultimately, I'm not sure exactly where the truth falls on all of that, but probably worth reminding everyone that Needham lived 1900 through 1995, and he was, I think, pretty active up and toward the end of his life as like an editor of these volumes. But Huang does not raise the specter of either inclination, though. He does look at new evidence, disagrees with a few Needham theories, but otherwise does not seem to oppose the second century BCE date, though does firmly base it in the analysis of Needham.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, coming back to this question, okay, why would you need your burning perfume? Why would you need your incense to have some sort of a mechanical system to keep it level? I mean, are you taking it on a ship? Are you running with it, right? Like, what's the purpose?
Yeah.
Well, this brings us to consideration of the spherical incense burner that had been previously referred to by archaeologists as a perfume ball, but eventually written descriptions were discovered that referred to them as xiangnang, which Huang translates as sachet, and which Yabla Chinese, which is a website for translating Mandarin, translates as spice ball. Now, to be clear, these are metal spheres as opposed to silk or cloth-bound bags of incense. So Wong points out that these metal spheres seem to have two primary uses in Tang Dynasty China. This would be, we're moving ahead several centuries here. This would be the period of 618 through 907 CE. So they would have two purposes, basically, as an incense burner, but also as a hand warmer, as well as, quote, a sensor amid the covers, which allowed it to set or, I guess, even roll around on bedding without fear of tipping over.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, so this is something that, based on some of the explanations I was reading, it kind of brings to mind this idea of, like, here's this, and you can look up images of this. They're ornate. It's a metal sphere, and inside there's a gimbaled system to keep a tray of burning coals and incense from tipping over. And then you would be able to place this amid some regal bedding, and the fumes from it would, of course, make the bed smell nice. The heat from it would potentially warm the bed. And I mean, I'm not sure from the descriptions I was reading if this is something that would actually stay there all night. Maybe it would, and maybe that's the idea, that you could be in the bed and you wouldn't have to worry about kicking it over and burning your covers.
Even with the gimbals, I don't know, that would kind of freak me out. But I guess I'm not used to it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's a fun history. I don't know if we could get a full invention episode out of this, but when you get into the history of bed warmers, it's pretty fascinating. Mm-hmm. The use of everything from essentially just hot bricks to, of course, bottles of water, and then, of course, various technological systems. I think we did touch on some of these in our history of the bed. Ideas where you have bed and heating apparatus in a home far more integrated than we're used to today.
Yeah.
In many parts of the world, I should mention, there are parts of the world where you still find this integration. So this is insightful here. Huang shares a description of this invention from a Western Han source. The source is, as the translated title, of Miscellaneous Records of the Western Capital, and it even credits some key inventors and innovators here. Quote, Ding Huan, a skilled craftsman from Chang'an, made an always full lamp. It had extraordinary decoration, sporting seven dragons and five phoenixes, which were supported by lotus-shaped platforms resting on stalks. He also created an incense burner, which lay on the bedcloths. It was also called the censer amid the covers. The technique is original from Fang Fing, a Han Dynasty skilled artisan, whose skills are unprecedented but now lost. It is not until Ding Huan that the technique is made possible again. To make it, Ding Huan fashioned a series of mechanically connected rings. The censer could roll in any direction, and yet the central incense burning chamber would remain level. Thus, one could position it on the bed covers. This is how it acquired its name.
Wow, so it is like the cup holder on board a ship, except instead of the ocean, it is the rollicking tide and waves of the bed.
Yeah. Yeah. So this would be a situation where, at least on some level, it passes the kid inventor test, and someone's like, no, look, we cannot have the bed covers burned anymore. We can't risk the bed covers being burned anymore. Is there not some sort of system we could employ here? And then once you see examples of it too, I think it's a situation where you kind of buy into the style of it as well. This idea that here's this sensor that has this internal novelty to it, but also looks quite beautiful, and then apparently can also be picked up and held as a hand warmer. Like it allows the space between the heat source, which again would not be a roaring fire, but like some hot coals, and it would allow. It's often when it's depicted or described, it's often like noble women or royal. Female members of the king's entourage, those kinds of individuals that might be holding one of these to keep them warm. So something fancy, but also useful.
Mm-hmm.
Other inventions attributed to Ding Huan, by the way, include an evaporative cooling system and something that might have just been like a flip book, but might have been some sort of a zoetrope kind of device. I think I think historians are kind of split on exactly what this might have been. It also might have just been some novel form of sequential artwork.
The first graphic novel.
Yeah, I mean, maybe so. Yeah, the history of sequential art is quite fascinating. So some of these balls, these metal spheres, they had chains for hanging. Others did not. These were apparently more used for bedding or hand warmers. So I think that's interesting as well, that you end up with hanging varieties of these, where I guess that would make sense. I don't know what would be shaking the room or the house so much, but I guess if you're going to have something hanging from a chain, there's the potential for that movement to take place, and therefore the gimbal system would potentially be useful.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the Ming Dynasty, it's also mentioned that specific types of incense could be used in one of these devices to ward away insects. So we have another practical use of the device here. And Huang describes that this design eventually spreads from China to the Islamic world and Venice, quote, possibly influencing the development of the gyroscope for maritime navigation in Europe. And he points out that while incense was widely used throughout the Islamic world, this was fascinating, it never became, according to this author, an essential part of Islamic ritual. But of course, the same cannot be said for Christianity, as we discussed in those incense episodes. So we do see the appearance of spherical incense burners in Islamic cultures, though not in religious ritual, again, based on this paper. But also, we do see spherical incense burners popping up in European churches and being involved in or very closely alongside religious rituals within Catholicism.
Okay, so generally, yes, secular, but not religious uses of incense in the Islamic world. In Christianity, we talked about this in the previous series on incense, that incense was mostly missing from Christian religious use until around the 4th and 5th century, and then it seems to be concurrent with the overtaking of the Roman Empire with Christianity as a dominant religion that incense becomes an integral part of Christian worship.
Yeah. Now, an important thing here, and I thought this was a great point, and it makes so much sense when you hear it spelled out. But when we talk about technologies and ideas spreading from one culture to the next, we often think of just a very sequential arrangement. Like you imagine something, say, traveling on the Silk Road out of China, or in this case, you can imagine this ball. Like, okay, now the ball goes to the Middle East, and it takes on Middle Eastern properties, and then it travels to Venice, and then it takes on European properties. End of story. But Huang points out that it's not just a matter of the technology traveling from China eventually to Europe, but there's a fair amount of eventual back and forth involving not only European craftsmen, but also Sasanian craftsmen. We of course talked about the Sasanian Empire in previous episodes as well. Persian, Iranian craftsmen adding their own touches to this type of technology, and then some of that flowing back. Quote, the metalwork utilized in the Tang Dynasty censer is a consequence of the chasing and hammering techniques taught to the Chinese by the Sasanian goldsmiths of Persia, while the culture of burning incense is from Indian Buddhism.
Hmm.
So there are various beautiful examples of where, like, you can look up the Chinese examples of these incense spheres, but you can also find some wonderful examples. For example, I included a picture here for you, Joe, of one of these that was apparently forged in Damascus around the 13th century, and you can see the elegant script in here.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
So with this invention, we see an early use of the gimbal, which at this time is largely, I guess, best used for just this purpose. Like here is something that you would want to keep stable. So here is how you can keep it stable. And then the artistry of the invention seems to take on a life of its own. And we see it employed in situations where maybe it doesn't make as much sense. But once you're crafting these beautiful globes of like silver and bronze and so forth, in there, you can imagine them emitting this sweet smelling smoke. It like kind of takes on a life all its own.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left, look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Now, another example that came up in the research here is the Pathekion. This is an example of a gimbal in action, and we have references to a device called the Pathekion, or Little Ape, as it is often translated, in a 2nd century text on siegecraft titled On Machines by an author that is referred to by historians as Athenaeus Mechanicus.
Oh, I'd seen, this is an interesting coincidence, I'd sometimes seen a Philo of Byzantium, the person cited with this early description of the gimbal in the 3rd century BCE, as sometimes called Philo Mechanicus, so I don't know where that appellation comes from.
Well, apparently in this case, it's because Athenaeus was a common enough name, and then in referring to this particular Athenaeus, we just add the title of the text they're most known for, On Machines. So this is Athenaeus Mechanicus.
Okay.
Some historians identify him with Athenaeus of Seleucia, but there are also some alternative theories as well. Again, this was a common name, and apparently some of the dating of it is based on the book's preface, which references one Marcellus. And according to historian David Whitehead, this causes the dating of the text to oscillate from as early as the late 3rd century BCE to the mid 3rd century CE. But anyway, the Seleucia idea would date this to mid to late 1st century BCE.
Okay.
The Whitehead here, along with P.H. Blythe, they're responsible for a 2004 translation of the On Machines text. So anyway, regardless on which Athenaeus wrote it and when exactly during this time period it was written, the book is largely concerned with siege machinery. And it's not that long of a text either. But later in the work, the author does make mention of the Pythekion, or the little ape. Whitehead describes it as follows in the 2015 paper, Athenaeus Mechanicus for the Oxford Classical Dictionary, quote, a device, perhaps involving nets or gimbals, for stabilizing shipborne machines when they are deployed in choppy seas.
Why is this an ape? I'm so curious about the name.
I have a lot of questions about that as well. And I ultimately have maybe more questions than answers here for everyone. But apparently this does relate to Roman siege craft, in which they would take merchant ships, yoke them together to bear the weight of siege weapons in attacking coastal towns. The little ape here was used, and this is where I get kind of foggy, apparently used to keep the machines from rolling around with the movement of the ships. That's one interpretation that I've seen, but I'm not sure about that. The quote from the text from On Machines says, you quote, you must fix the Pythekion on the platform attached to the merchant ships in the middle so that the machine stays upright in any angle.
Well, I don't know. I mean, at this period of time, I don't know how much minute aiming would be involved in the use of siege weapons. But of course, gimbals are very useful in the mounting of modern weapons, like of you know, machine gun turrets and stuff like that. Or if they're within like a ship or an airplane or something, they can be mounted within gimbals in order to stabilize for aiming purposes. Because otherwise, like, you're trying to aim while the ground or the housing is rocking all over the place.
Yeah, I have a very hard time imagining a gimbal system big enough on a Roman ship that would accommodate some sort of really robust form of siege work machinery, you know, like some sort of a large crossbow or catapult type device. It seems like it would make more sense if it was designed for some more subtle tool of siege craft, some sort of, as we see in the nautical tradition, something that would aid in the use of siege weapons, but not the siege weapon itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when I looked around for more examples, more descriptions of what the Pythekion would have looked like, indeed why it is compared to an ape, I wasn't able to find much. I was looking at... in one case, I was reading about deck-based weapons. I was looking at The Navies of Rome by Michael Pitassi, and they mentioned that during the war between Caesar and Pompey, the latter constructed three-story towers atop merchant ships and mounted artillery on them and used these against Caesar's blockade. Just as an example of something that the Romans would have done with merchant ships in some sort of a combat scenario. But there's no mention of gimbal technology in that book, as far as I could tell. And he does cite a text by Athenaeus at one point, or by an Athenaeus. But yeah, so I wasn't really able to find much in the way of answers about exactly what the little ape was achieving. But it would seem, based on all these other examples, it seems like we would probably be talking about a way to keep some sort of measurement tool steady, as opposed to some sort of large catapult or crossbow or what have you.
Okay.
I did find a wonderful illustration, though. This was used, I think this was in Huang's article. I could be mistaken on that, but it's a drawing from 1567 by Jacques Besson's book. Let's see, what is this? Le Cosmolabe?
Le Cosmolabe?
Le Cosmolabe. But it's a wonderful illustration of a ship, and we see this fascinating, and I have a hard time imagining if this was ever built either, but we see like a table and chair, like basically a little desk, a little office mounted inside this large spherical gimbal system that it takes up a large portion of the ship in this illustration.
Yeah, I can see you have a gimbal system if you want to like mount a platform on which you can put a pool table on a ship so that you can play pool or you can play ping pong.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, with illustrations like this, if it's more about sort of illustrating the purpose, or if it's a telephone game of relating what a gimbal is and how it functions in a naval context. And then, of course, you're also probably getting into the situation where, while it might, if you're just familiar with the basics of the gimbal, you might think, well, yeah, let's just put the whole office in the gimbal. Why can't we put the whole ship in the gimbal? Everybody on the ship is in the gimbal, and then nobody will get sick. And man, you know, the reality is probably a bit different from that.
But, I guess once you get enough weight, you're probably putting a lot of strain on the little pivot hinges for those rings.
Yeah, so you probably come back to the situation then either in practicality, you know, through experimentation or through just learning more about what they're actually doing out there at sea, you realize, no, this makes the most sense as a way to keep specialized tools steady, generally small measurement tools, or burning incense, certainly.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So we mentioned earlier that systems of orthogonal gimbals are used in many technologies today, and one major theater of use is space travel. And funny enough, I actually found an old How Stuff Works article about this by our colleague Jonathan Strickland of the podcast Tech Stuff, highlighting the use of gimbals by NASA. If you're not familiar, Rob and I, we've been doing this podcast for a while, but we started doing it long ago under the auspices of a website called How Stuff Works.
Yep.
So in this short little article, Jonathan highlights a number of different uses of gimbals by NASA. For example, a harness mounted within a gimbal system is sometimes used to simulate spacewalks during astronaut training. So you want to get astronauts used to, you know, the different ways that their body will sort of float around and reorient smoothly in space if they're trying to do, say, external repairs on a spacecraft or something. Of course, the gimbals will not remove the influence of Earth's gravity, but they will simulate other aspects of spacewalking, the way that you can, you know, change your body's orientation in any direction in space. And then, of course, there are lots of other uses within spacecraft and the mechanical parts. So, like, you might have motorized gimbals to orient solar panels to keep facing the sun, even as the position of a space station changes. Of course, there are detectors and sensors. For example, an instrument called the Inertial Measurement Unit, which is a sort of mechanical inner ear. It measures the orientation of a spacecraft, so pitch, roll, and yaw, and it also measures acceleration. And I guess this also highlights different ways that gimbals can be used. I mean, most of the gimbals we've been talking about have been free rotating gimbals that are supposed to allow, say, a platform to keep its orientation with respect to the Earth's gravity, no matter how the outer housing moves. So in that case, it would just be the goal of the different gimbals in the cardan suspension, or the even just one or two gimbals. The purpose would just be that they can rotate easily and freely, smooth movement to allow a naturally gravity-oriented platform to stay as it is. But you can also, of course, create motorized gimbals if you want to intentionally maintain the orientation of a central object or platform with some kind of external control mechanism. And gimbal systems like this have proven very useful for cameras. So imagine you are trying to shoot something, keep something in focus, keep a subject of a frame in focus while the camera itself is moving. You're shooting moving video. If you just hold a camera and then you walk or run, if you ever tried this, Rob, like, you will often be very dissatisfied with the results. There's a lot of jostling.
Yeah. Like Blair Witch effect times 10.
Yeah. So to keep the movement smooth, you can make a mounting system with motorized gimbals that detect the movement coming up through the frame that's holding the camera, and then use little computers inside to algorithmically adjust the camera itself to cancel out that movement. So it's not just allowing the camera to sort of like rotate freely within the gimbal system. It's actually making adjustments deliberately to smooth out any jostling that comes through the housing.
You know, in the natural world, of course, as we're looking around, there's kind of a gimbling effect just to our the way we position our head. But it's also been pointed out that the chicken is a natural gimbal. It's nature's gimbal. The way a chicken can keep its head perfectly stationary whilst someone holding the chicken moves its body around.
Oh, yeah.
There's some really fun videos of this, including one that I'm not sure if this was an April Fool's video or not, but it's a parody in which they're saying, well, we've discovered the ultimate for photography and filmmaking gimbals. We just put a little camera on top of the chicken's head and then use the chicken as the gimbal, which I thought was very, very funny. Now, not only can you keep things stable with this kind of a layout, you can also, of course, just mess with whatever is strapped in the middle. Particularly, I'm thinking of those various gyroscope mounting systems. You would see these sometimes at like carnivals. I remember seeing these perhaps at carnivals or in sort of like carnival type towns where you could come up, you paid your money, and they would strap you into one of these things and just spin you around. I think sometimes there's a virtual reality headset that is employed in these. And of course, if you've ever seen any kind of VR exploitation film, I'm particularly thinking of the Lawnmower Man films here, but films like that, there's always going to be a scene where somebody puts on some sort of shiny jumpsuit, some VR goggles, and then they're put in some sort of like neon strobe light gyroscope or gimbaled system, and then they're spinning all over the place.
Does Pierce Brosnan get in one of those, or is that just Jeff Fahey?
I think they both do, yeah.
Okay.
I think also sometimes with mechs you see this, right? I can't remember if we saw this sort of outfit in Robot Jocks, but I feel like maybe they had it in, Pacific Rim or one of these type of shows.
Hmm. Well, we've hit our Lawnmower Man quota, so I think it may be time to call this episode.
Yeah, but I thought this was fascinating, especially when you get, again, it's kind of like the wheel where you begin asking questions. All right, at what point in human history is this technology both possible and, achievable and also recognizable? Like, at what point might someone have made one of these at least as a lark? But then at what point does it become practical to put something in the middle of it? At what point is it practical to build a cart, to build even a very simple cart? At what point does it become practical to build some sort of gimbaled system to keep something steady if there's not truly a practical reason for it?
When will we discover the meaning of the little ape?
True, yes. So if anyone out there has insight on that, certainly write in, let us know. And just in general, examples of amazing gimbals from other technologies, other cultures and histories, write in. We would love to hear from you. I especially would love to hear from anyone who's seen some other great examples of these globes that burn incense in various cultures in which they were built and designed. Write in, let us know, send us your photos. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to see them. In the meantime, we'll remind you that Stuff to Blow Your Mind publishes its core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. You'll find that feed wherever you get your podcasts these days. And on Mondays, we do listener mail. On Wednesdays, we do a short form artifact or monster fact episode. And then on Fridays, we do Weird House Cinema. That is a time for us to set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film. And I have to say, we didn't even think about the synergy between this episode and the movie that we're going to be discussing this Friday.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission,
parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.